From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. According to a Washington Post ABC News poll out today, Donald Trump is the least popular incoming president in at least four decades, with a 40% approval rating. In response, Donald Trump tweeted out, "The same people who did the phony election polls and were so wrong are now doing approval rating polls. They are rigged just like before." But around 40 Democratic congressmen have announced they will not attend his inauguration, many because Trump said civil rights icon Georgia Congressman John Lewis was all talk after Lewis said he didn't think Trump was a legitimate president. Democratic Tennessee Congressman Steve Cohen joins us. Congressman, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Jerry Nadler is saying that, in part, he's refusing to applaud a man with a history of offensive and abusive behavior to women and minorities. Others are saying they don't want to normalize an election that may have been the result of foreign interference by Russians. What's your reasoning?
All of those are part of it, but the straw that broke the camel's back was John Lewis. John Lewis is one of the most heroic and courageous people to ever serve in the United States Congress, and one of the most heroic and courageous on the face of the earth. And for Donald Trump to say that he was just talk, 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 and no action was insulting and ignorant. My district is the most African-American district of any in the United States of America. And I know the civil rights struggle from my experiences of a history student, a resident of Memphis, and you don't do that. And you should revere John Lewis. And the fact that Donald Trump doesn't know him or the movement is frightening.
And you're referring to the fact that John Lewis, who walked with Martin Luther King, was beaten in the Selma March, for instance. Look, I'm sure others who agree with you about John Lewis would say the same thing, but they are going. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, a huge critic of Donald Trump, says she wants to witness the transfer of power. The Clintons will be there. Isn't this the time to show unity to the world that is watching this inauguration very closely?
Well, I think there's going to be lots of people there. Donald Trump has made a point of encouraging people to come. And I think he sees it as a reaffirmation of himself, as I think he sees so much. I think that as a congressman from a district that was 80% for Hillary Clinton, that is 65% African-American, and thinks that he has insulted probably the last apostle of Martin Luther King, that my major impact can be by not attending and not being there as a witness. He wants witnesses. He wants acolytes. And I'm not going to be one.
But what about the words of Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high? You know how Democrats felt when Donald Trump actually led the campaign perpetuating the myth, the complete myth, that President Obama wasn't a legitimate president. You know how Democrats felt then. Do you feel comfortable doing this to the people who sincerely voted for Donald Trump?
You know, I'm giving tickets to every single person that asked from my district for tickets. I had a thought about it, and I thought, do I want to reward these people who think so differently than I and who would certainly never support anything I do? And I see them on Twitter and I see them on Facebook, and they say nasty things to me and have for every issue I've ever had championed, whether it was civil rights, voting rights, safety on guns. And I'm going to give those tickets out to those people, and I'm going to see them, and I'm going to talk to them.
What are you going to say to them?
I'm going to say, I hope you have a great time. You're going to enjoy it, and it's a great time. I went to Bill Clinton's first inauguration, and I've been to the last two inaugurations of Barack Obama. They were great shows. I enjoyed being there. But then there was a candidate that I supported, and it's a celebration. It'll be a celebration for these Trump people, but it will not be a celebration for me. It's going to be everything I am concerned about in America, because Donald Trump's appointments, appointing Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, nominating him to be the attorney general, you might as well have nominated George Wallace.
But what does this do for the democracy, Congressman? The last several elections have been fraught. There have been claims of illegitimacy about, we mentioned Barack Obama. Democrats felt George Bush was illegitimately put into office by a Supreme Court decision. What does this do to our democracy if, you know, people like you, you know, harden that thinking by not attending an inauguration?
You know, I think that attending the inauguration, it's a symbolic thing. I understand that there'll be plenty of people. He's going to be president. I don't question the fact that he won the Electoral College and he's going to be president. But I will not put my imprimatur, my position, myself as a surety for an ego run wild. Mitt Romney, I would have been there. I'd have been there for almost any one of the other Republican candidates. I think any one of them.
That's Steve Cohen, who represents the 9th District in Tennessee and is joining others and saying they will not go to the inauguration on Friday. Congressman Cohen, thanks for speaking to us about it.
You're welcome. And let's hope that the State of the Union is calm.
Let's hope so. And we will be there broadcasting from Washington on Friday. Well, in London today, Prime Minister Theresa May delivered her much-anticipated speech on Brexit, and she signaled that the UK will make a clean break from the European Union.
We seek not partial membership or anything that leaves us half in, half out. No, the United Kingdom is leaving the European Union, and my job is to get the right deal for Britain as we do.
Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. And Rob, it seems like a pretty clear signal that it's going to be a hard Brexit. Is that your sense?
It is. You know, people have been using these phrases, hard Brexit, soft Brexit,
yeah.
Clear Brexit. You know, I'm going to make it even more straightforward than that. And I'm not sure that Theresa May would entirely thank me for this. But look, to cut through it all the flim-flam of all these terms, I mean, it seems to me that what she has said very clearly in her speech is that, look, Britain wants all the things that it likes about relations with Europe, namely free trade, cooperating on things like security, but it doesn't want any of the stuff that it doesn't like, such as being a member of a supranational political body like the European Union, and things like the free movement of people. So it seems to me that it now very much depends on what will be the reaction of the EU27. Are they prepared to have a free trade deal with Britain? And what also will be the reaction of those multinational and other businesses and banks based in Britain who have contributed to this country being the fifth richest in the world under the current arrangements?
But she didn't give any real nuts and bolts about how her plan would work, did she? So we are still kind of in a period of we don't know what's going to happen.
Oh, no, look, absolutely. What she gave was big picture, but I think that big picture is important. And for anyone who was maybe a bit too kind of, I don't know, just didn't want to read through what she's really been saying the last 7 months, she made it pretty clear, and that is, look, Britain is not seeking to sort of stay in the European Union, but to do something entirely new. And that entirely new thing, as I say, whatever kind of fancy way you try and dress it up, is to say, look, Britain just wants the bits about Europe that it likes, particularly free trade.
But they're willing to have none of that if that's what a hard Brexit means?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I would describe Theresa May's approach today as the velvet fist. So the velvet bit was saying, we want to really send a message to you guys in Europe. We're not leaving because we want your whole project to fail and because we don't like you. We're leaving because basically Britain's just a bit different to other European countries. And then here's the kind of fist bit. She said, but we've heard word that some of you there in Europe think that Britain should be punished for Brexit. She had that really steely look that she gets where you think, crikey, I wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of her. She said, you know, Europe would end up worse from such a fight than the UK would.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more of Theresa May speaking today. She said Britain will continue to make sure it can control immigration from Europe to the UK.
We will continue to attract the brightest and the best to work or study in Britain. Indeed, openness to international talent must remain one of this country's most distinctive assets. But that process must be managed properly so that our immigration system serves the national interest.
So obviously a lot of Brexit had to do with immigration coming in from Europe. How are people feeling there now in the UK, Rob, about what they're hearing now about a hard Brexit?
The really interesting thing is that opinion hasn't really shifted very much since the referendum on the 23rd. In other words, those who voted Remain, by and large, still think that they were right. And those who voted Brexit also think they were right. I guess what I would say is that one of the points in Theresa May's speech today was this idea. She said, look, we've all moved on from the debate. We all want to come together and to make a new post-EU Britain a success. But I mean, I fear again that just because a politician wishes something doesn't make it so. This is still a deeply, deeply divided country. I mean, the whole referendum exacerbated divisions in British society that were sort of there and lying maybe a bit dormant. And I'm afraid those divisions just haven't gone away, whatever the Prime Minister might like to think.
Rob, one more question. We're just days away from the inauguration of Donald Trump in this country. We've heard, you know, over the last couple months about the relationship between Trump and the British government. And we know he's good friends with Nigel Farage, who was one of the big pro-Brexit people. But How is that relationship looking right now?
I've got to say that the prospect of that first meeting between Donald Trump and Theresa May has got to be a doozy, as they say. I mean, it's hard to imagine two people more different. Donald Trump with the sort of the man cave in Trump Tower, and Theresa May, the incredibly proper daughter of a clergyman. So, you know, it's going to be extraordinary. I guess more broadly, of course, Britain finds itself in this extraordinary position where lots of the politicians who a year ago were saying Donald Trump is the kind of man who's not fit for office are now finding themselves having to accept and to welcome and do deals with him, partly because, of course, he won, but partly because, of course, leaving the European Union has made Britain feel like it's more dependent on the United States, no matter what they think of the man about to go into the White House.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, in London. Rob, thanks so much, as always.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
As Barack Obama's presidency comes to an end, we've been taking a look at how he will be remembered. What were his promises? What did he achieve? And where did he fall short? Michael D'Antonio has written a book about that. It's called A Consequential President, The Legacy of Barack Obama. He's with us now from New York. And Michael, we're not going to be able to go through everything Obama did in his 8 years as president, but let's look at how he handled some of the big issues. And from the beginning, President Obama was facing Republicans in Congress that were not willing to go along with him. One of the first big things he had to do was pass the stimulus package during the financial crisis and the recession. And he didn't get one House Republican to support that bill.
No, this is because they met on the night of his inauguration and agreed to oppose everything he did. The intent was to make him a one-term president and to make him a failure. And this is something that current Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell confesses to later on. He says that he wanted Obama to fail. And I think if he had proposed to give everybody a free slice of apple pie, he would have met opposition on that, too. There wasn't anything this guy could propose that he was going to get bipartisan support on. So that's, I think, very exemplary of this ratcheting up of divisive political tactics over the years. And we're now seeing that that's taking place today in Washington, and it just seems to get worse and worse.
Well, what do you think Obama's economic legacy is going to be? Because here we are 8 years later and the unemployment rate is below 5%. It was right around 10% at the beginning of his time as president. And the stock market has, you know, more than tripled since he took office.
Well, what you're talking about affects both ends of the political spectrum. So you've got a lot of lower wage, unfortunately, service jobs being created, not enough high wage jobs for the people who want them. And at the same time, you have this tripling of the stock market and actually a rebound down real estate. But this means that inequality may be a little bit worse than it was when the president took office. And that is where people feel this disconnect. You know, my book is about his achievements primarily because I tracked about 15 or 20 promises he made, and he came through on most of them. But he didn't make the progress that I think he hoped he would on inequality, in part because there's only so much a president can do. And I think this is something Donald Trump is going to discover if he hasn't realized it already. There's very little the president can do except at the margins to move the economy.
One of the other issues that you go into here is what President Obama achieved when it comes to energy and changing America's energy landscape, trying to get us more into wind and solar. Now, there was the famous problem with the solar startup Solyndra. There was a $535 million loan guarantee, and then the company went under. But overall, what do you think about Obama's energy legacy?
Well, this is one area where he succeeded, I think, beyond his expectations. The increase in solar power, wind power, has been enormous. He was helped, ironically, by the plummeting price in hydrocarbons. You see, between natural gas and oil prices, a real advantage accruing to the Obama administration where the economy is concerned. What I think is the most interesting thing about this, though, is how his environmental policy, his energy policy, and even his economic policy, and you could throw in foreign affairs, all kind of clicked together. This was not a case of him pursuing one without a thought for the other. Mm. In fact, the energy policy was good for his environmental policy, and the standards he set for the auto industry, for example, to increase miles per gallon was directly beneficial economically, but also for the environment. And then you can throw in the accord on climate change and see that he had pledged America to improvements before he even got to Paris to conclude those negotiations. So America was on firm ground with the other participants in the talks who wanted to see the developed world go first with its reductions in emissions, and then they were willing to come along.
One of the big criticisms that people have of President Obama, especially on the left, is that he did not end up closing the military base at Guantanamo Bay. You looked at some of his failures in the both domestic and international arena. What did you find about where he didn't succeed?
Well, Guantanamo is a big example. I think, again, this is a place where he ran into a real buzzsaw in Congress, which actually wouldn't authorize the closing of Guantanamo's prison. And as a result, he couldn't fulfill a promise he had made not only to the United States, but to the world. There are other areas. Syria is a primary example where he couldn't find a solution. And I think he very much wanted to. He made the mistake of declaring a red line being drawn. And then when it was crossed, he didn't have the option to respond to it. So those are two big areas of failure for him. I think he would also see at home his failure when it comes to guns to be a profound problem. Now, laying this all on him and saying failure, failure, failure is, of course, unfair. Mm-hmm. But the truth is we haven't moved at all when it comes to gun safety. And it's been one tragedy heaped upon another. And I think
He would have liked to have done something. He said it. It's just he's had no support in Congress.
Well, of course he's had no support. And I think some of the most moving moments of the Obama presidency were when he was grieving for our country, for these lives that have been lost in mass shootings. And I think he was severely affected by it. I mean, this, you could see it in his face and hear it in his voice. And there are moments when he shed tears over these deaths.
How do you think history is going to judge Barack Obama when compared with all the other presidents?
Well, I see two or three major achievements on his part. The first is the restoration of a kind of dignity and integrity to the White House. I looked back as far as Eisenhower, and this was the least scandal-plagued presidency since Ike. There were no prosecutions or even charges brought against a single figure in the Obama administration's upper echelon. That is a stunning turnaround from the days of Reagan and Bush 1 and Clinton and Bush 2. So I think integrity and decency is one area where he'll be held up in high regard. And I also think saving the economy from the depths of the Great Recession, which was the second worst economic collapse in the last century, and really devastated American society. That was a huge accomplishment. It will be seen in the future as even more significant. And finally, I think that his goodwill, his optimism, that hope that he did communicate when posed, especially against what I think is going to come with Donald Trump, who I know quite well, is going to be seen as a true exemplary element of his presidency. He made people believe in their best, and I think that that's what a leader does.
Well, let's go to that, what you just said, because you say you know Trump quite well. You've written a book on Trump as well. What do you think about the fact that the country that elected Barack Obama twice also elected Donald Trump?
Well, I think this is an illustration of how difficult it is for any politician to transfer his popularity to a successor. You look at Bill Clinton, he could not transfer his popularity to Gore, and Obama could not do it with Hillary Clinton. I think he also didn't succeed when it comes to building the Democratic Party. So that's a those are two things that I think we have to understand about why Trump was elected. At the same time, there has been no let up in the polarization of our politics. Obama was not able to bridge that gap. In fact, it grew wider during his presidency. And we also have to remember that by a large margin, about 3 million people, Donald Trump lost the popular vote. So I don't see this as a sign that the country was rejecting Obama's achievements and his model wholesale. I think that there was a perfect storm of political factors, and the Electoral College came into play in an unusual way that allowed Trump to be elected. But I don't think that that means that we've abandoned who we were when we chose Barack Obama.
When people drive around this country in 50 years, do you think, or whatever we do at that point, get driven in our self-driving cars, do you think that we're going to be seeing Barack Obama Elementary School, Barack Obama Airport, Barack Obama Highway, and all that?
I'm absolutely sure of it. And I think especially in our major cities, he's made an impact on the way that people imagine the American scene. You know, this is not only the president himself, but the first family changed forever how people can think about who occupies the White House, who will be our leaders. And I think that's not going to go away.
That's Michael D'Antonio, who is the author of the new book, A Consequential President, The Legacy of Barack Obama. Michael, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And we did learn today that the first thing the Obamas are going to do after the inauguration is take a vacation to Palm Springs.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
A soda costs more today in Philadelphia than it did a couple of weeks ago. The city's new tax on sweetened drinks went into effect on January 1st. Kay Culinary from Here Now contributor WHYY explains why consumers are paying more.
Philadelphia's 1.5 cents per ounce tax on soda, iced teas, and other sugary drinks is levied on beverage distributors, the companies that sell drinks to retailers like restaurants, corner stores, and supermarkets. That includes major corporations like Coca-Cola, Sunny Delight, and Cisco, and independent business owners like Andy Pincus. Pincus runs Carbonator Rental Services, the company his dad started in 1955. He shows me around his warehouse in southwest Philadelphia. The air in here smells sweet. That's because Pincus sells the syrup that gets mixed with fizzy water in soda fountains.
It's a five-gallon box of our private label cola.
Just one of those big boxes of syrup makes about 220-ounce cups of soda. Depending on whether it's his own label or a national brand like Coke, Pincus charges anywhere from $60 to $90 a box. But now, every time he sells one to a customer in Philadelphia, Pincus owes the city $57.60 in taxes.
We're not talking about a couple of bucks on a $60 item. We're talking about $57.60 on a $60 item. It's too big not to pass on.
Why? Well, for one thing, for every box of syrup Pincus sells, he says he makes between $3 and $18. Out of that, he has to pay his delivery truck drivers, buy fuel for the truck, and other costs of doing business. So Pincus says he can't afford to absorb the tax himself. He has to pass it on to his customers. And he says some of them were not happy when they got their new bills.
They started yelling at my drivers as if they have something to do with it, with customers telling them this isn't right, like as if we're making a mistake.
Alan Janone runs a catering business and restaurant in Northeast Philadelphia. Every month, he buys 8 of those big syrup boxes for his soda fountain. Now, those boxes cost him an extra $400 a month. That's why last week, the price of a glass of soda at Janone's restaurant went up 30 cents to $2.95.
Because a 20-ounce glass 20-ounce cost me 30 cents extra. I'm only charging what they're charging me.
And many retailers throughout Philadelphia are doing the same thing, at least for now.
I think after a while, things will shake out.
Stephen Balsam is a tax expert at Temple University. He thinks eventually distributors and retailers in Philadelphia will start to absorb some of the tax and lower their prices. He says it's economics 101. When stuff costs more, people buy less.
And when sales go down, the retailers, the wholesalers, they get more competitive. They don't like to lose the business. So they will absorb some of that.
In Berkeley, California, the only other city in America with a sweetened drinks tax, a study found consumers pay between 30 and 70% of the penny per ounce tax there, depending on the beverage. To be clear, Philadelphia's new law doesn't require distributors to pass on the tax. But right now, distributors like Pincus insist they have no choice.
If any one of the distributors, and this is a very competitive industry, if any one of the distributors thought for one moment they can gain a competitive advantage by not passing the tax on, they do it. And that hasn't happened.
And he doesn't think it will anytime soon. In the meantime, the soda industry is fighting to overturn the tax in court. For Here and Now, I'm Katie Culinary.
And if you're not a teenager, you may not have heard of our next guest. But at 14 years old, he has 14 million followers on the app Musical.ly, 7 million followers on Instagram, and more than 2 million subscribers to his YouTube channel. And he's about to release his first EP called The Last Text and go out on his first world tour. He's been compared to Justin Bieber, who was also discovered online when he was barely in his teens. And his name is Jacob Sartorius. He joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Well, and take us back to the beginning of how this all started for you, because you've achieved something that a lot of people would love to do.
It started in my bedroom with making content. It started with musical theater, from performing every day. It really built kind of fast. I started in my bedroom with zero followers, and I grew it to something that I didn't expect with a lot of hard work, and I just have always wanted to be where I am right now.
Well, what was your first big hit online?
My first ever social media post was on Vine, and it was a message against bullying, because that was something that I faced when I went to school every day, just because I was interested in things that other people weren't. So I think that was really relatable, and it pretty much just blew up overnight.
And it was seen by how many people in the end?
Right now, I think it has like 16 million loops on Vine.
And why do you think that so many people were attracted to that?
I just think it's something that people face every day. I just wanted other people to know that they're not alone, because I faced it. I know what they've been through. And
when you say you faced it, what are you talking about there?
Well, I mean, with kids saying things to my face every day at school, I mean, I faced bullying from like 5th grade to 7th grade, and 7th grade was when it got like really bad. And then I had to leave school because of it, and I just had different interests. And other kids, obviously, whether they're on the basketball team or the baseball team, everybody has their own interests. And I was respectful to theirs, but they didn't really understand what I was trying to do. But yeah, I kind of just faced that every day.
So how do you go from that, a video on Vine about bullying to lip-syncing videos on Musical.ly?
I started with musical theater, obviously. So music was always something that I was passionate about. And it went to something where I could actually make Musical.lys to songs that I enjoyed, whether it was on the radio or my own songs. It was really cool because I just got to vibe out with the music, which was really important to me. I think it's all just because I love music.
What do you think about being compared to Justin Bieber? A lot of people think you're the next Justin Bieber.
I think it's a big honor. I think it's kind of crazy, like in a good way, because I've looked up to him since I was a little kid and listening to all his music. He's a great artist, and people like that are the people that I look up to.
What have you learned from him?
He's just a great performer, great dance moves, great vocals. I've learned a lot from people like him and Shawn Mendes and Ed Sheeran and people like that. Those are just like people that I've always looked up to. I've learned a lot from Justin.
And what about being in the public eye? What have you learned from him about that? Because he's had his ups and downs. He obviously has been famous since he was young, and he, you know, sometimes has gotten in trouble with the public because of the things that he's done.
I think at the end of the day, we're all just human, and I think if you have so many people looking at you, you're bound to make mistakes. But the most important thing is to just be able to get back up and obviously just keep going. I mean, I think he's a super strong person for all that he's been through. Not any normal person can just put out new music and kill it on a world tour. So I give him like a lot of credit for
that. Have you ever been angry at anything that he's done?
I don't think so, no. I mean, I think everybody's done things that they regret. I've done things that I regret. I think other kids, I think we're all just human. I think that's the main thing.
Well, do you feel like you ever have to hold yourself back from doing what you would want to do because you're in the spotlight and a lot of people and a lot of young people in particular are watching you and watching what you're doing?
I don't think so. I think in a way it actually has helped me because I know that I have people that look up to me every single day. I have people that look at my pages all day, look at my videos, look at my music videos. It's crazy because I just want to be the best influencer I can, be the best musician I can, and just make the best impact I can. So I try to uphold a certain standard. I just want to be as positive, and of course I'm going to make mistakes along the way, but the important thing is that I get back up and just keep fighting.
Well, we've heard about people like Taylor Swift, for example, who was, you know, early in her career, she was really followed by a lot of young girls in particular, and she didn't want to be ever photographed with a beer, for example, because she didn't want to set that example for those people. Now, you're only 14, so hopefully you wouldn't be photographed with a beer anyway, but do you ever have to do things like that to try to make sure that you're setting the right tone for your followers?
Not really. I try to just be as relatable as I can. I kind of just live my life, and now it's in the spotlight, which is really cool. It's different, because the first 13 years of my life has not been that way. There's a lot of adjustments, obviously, but yeah, it's really awesome.
One of the things that is difficult about social media is that the social networks come and go. They're not there forever. The ones that are popular might be popular now and then not popular tomorrow. How do you navigate that, especially with something like Vine that you used a lot and now it's gone?
I think the important thing, it should always come back to the music. I think music's here for the long term. I'm in the studio every day just working on upcoming projects like my new EP. And if we're talking about apps, I think people's interests come and go like with the apps. So I think Vine was great for people that wanted to do comedy, people that wanted to do covers like Shawn Mendes. And I think Musical.ly is great for people that want to do covers also or just vibe out with some music. And I think it's really great for the music industry.
What's your favorite social media platform at this point?
I think it would have to be Snapchat or Instagram. Just because Snapchat, I can share little snippets of my life. And Instagram, I get to show little pictures of my life, which is pretty awesome.
And you've got a lot of people who love you online, but you've also got some haters out there who have, you know, how do you deal with that?
I mean, I just focus my energy. I feel like if you focus your energy on positive things, I think it's positive. So I know there's a lot of haters out there. And I mean, I just put my energy into the positive comments and I just read those because I have the loveliest fans.
So you're about to release your first album, and you're about to go on tour.
Yeah.
What's on your mind when it comes to all of that?
Oh, excitement, I'd say. It's a big relief, actually, because this is something that I've always wanted to do, and I have some songs that I've put my heart into like crazy, like I've never done before. So it's just a whole new thing, and I'm just really excited for people to hear it.
And what's the message of the album?
I'd say it's really about finding that one person that you can just be with, whether you're a boy or a girl, works for either. And the thing that I hope people take away from it is that you can just listen to the music and forget about what you're doing, forget about what's wrong.
And are you writing the songs on your own?
I've been collaborating with a lot of producers, engineers, co-writing. I've just been lucky enough to work with some great, great people, people that I never thought I would be able to work with.
I just want to go back to this main theme here, which, you know, a lot of people maybe in our audience haven't heard of you, haven't seen you, but certainly there are now millions and millions of people who have. What are the challenges for you of being famous at a young age?
Well, if I go to the grocery store with my mom, which happens a lot.
You still go to the regular old grocery store with your mom?
Yeah, every day. if she's picking out some fruits, maybe somebody will notice me, which is really cool. And I take a picture, meet them, get to know them. I've met a lot of cool people the past like 6 months. And it's kind of, at times it can be a little bit of stress, a little bit of pressure to just be the best person I can. But I think my fans keep me grounded, my fans keep me humble, and I just I've been lucky enough to work with a great team.
Well, Jacob Sartorius, whose first EP, The Last Text, is going to be released this week on Friday.
Yep.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
As if there wasn't enough going on in Washington, D.C. this week, tomorrow, four members of the Asian American rock band The Slants will be in town as their lawyers defend their name before the Supreme Court.
Sorry if my notes too sharp. Sorry if my voice too raw.
That's From the Heart, which The Slants say is kind of an open letter to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, which declared the group's name hate speech and denied their request for a trademark. Now, The Slants say that's the point. It is hate speech, that unlike the Redskins, which tried to piggyback on their case, The Slants are using a pejorative, this one about Asian eyes, as a protest against bigotry. An appeals court agreed with them and said not granting the trademark is a violation of their First Amendment rights. And so it's on to the Supremes tomorrow. Rebecca Tushnet is professor of law at Georgetown Law. She joins us from the NPR studios in D.C. And Professor, there are groups, NWA comes to mind, the N is the N-word. They're registered, but you've explained to us, registering is just going on record that you're using a name. A trademark gives you the sole right to use it, so whether it's insulting is considered. Explain.
So trademarks are the way that we indicate the source of goods and services, and there's a federal law that governs both trademark infringement and trademark registration, which is a separate thing where you get a certificate from the government saying that you have a nationally valid mark. Mm-hmm. And the PTO denied the registration, saying that a substantial portion of the referenced group, in this case Asian Americans, would perceive the term as disparaging. And that's a prohibition that applies across the board for any disparaging term for a registration. It doesn't affect their right to use it, but they are challenging the decision to reject it on that ground.
This is something that was put into law in the 40s, but tell us more about the thinking behind this and the law behind this.
So the modern term disparaging, it comes from 1947. The drafters of the Lanham Act were concerned about false connections, misrepresentations. They wanted to make sure that people couldn't, say, put Abraham Lincoln's name on a jug of whiskey, and they thought that would be disparaging. So they added that in, implementing a kind of larger, longer existing policy against marks contrary to public morals.
Yeah, so interesting. We're understanding that the trademark office looked in the Urban Dictionary when it came to considering slants and saw that it was considered a pejorative. But what did the appeals court say in supporting the slants?
The Court of Appeals said that it was a content-based regulation of the slant's speech. And so that's very hard to sustain under the First Amendment, and that the government didn't have a sufficiently good interest in rejecting the mark.
So what does that mean, content? What does that mean?
So this is a big issue in the Supreme Court generally. If you have to look at what a person is saying to figure out whether they violated the law, that's content-based. So almost all regulations of speech are content-based. A regulation, say, on how loud you could be in the street would not be content-based, because we would just measure your decibels and not what you were saying.
Well, and so the content here is they are saying, we are using this because we think it is a word of bigotry, and that's a statement we're making that, you know, we're against bigotry. Because there are people who are concerned that this case could be a slippery slope towards anyone using a pejorative word. But does that content mean, for instance, that a white supremacist group that wanted to call themselves the N-word band because they are for disparaging minorities wouldn't have the same content and maybe not the same result in an appeals court?
Yeah. So the slants are arguing that you should make an exception for them because of their intent to reclaim. They don't like being grouped with the white supremacist or the Redskins. But the legal principles really don't offer much room for that argument. Huh. In fact, if anything, that would be more discriminatory on the basis of their content, since we'd start looking at their perspective, their viewpoint.
Right. Well, so what is the legal community thinking? Is there a concern that this is going to open the gate to anybody trademarking any disparaging word they want?
So I would think it's fair to say there's a fair amount of division. Most of the people who support the slants say, yes, the market is going to have to take care of the N-word band. That if it is popular and successful, then it will be popular and successful, and it'll turn out that people tolerate that. Otherwise, it will be unpopular and unsuccessful, and maybe people will be turned off by the name. But the argument is that the consumers will do that, and people see that as a good thing, that the government will no longer be determining that a particular word is disparaging for purposes of registration. But absolutely, that is the consequence.
Rebecca Tushnet, professor of law at Georgetown Law. Again, the band, the slants, will be in Washington, D.C. tomorrow as this case goes before the Supreme Court. They're going to perform outside the court, regardless of the outcome. It'll either be a rally or a protest. Professor, thanks so much for helping us look at this.
Thank you.